Where's Clara? She's not here? Okay. So, can you hear me okay? Just a little bit up. Is that better? Oh, that's scary. I can hear myself. Is that okay?
Yeah.
So we're going to, I always have these projects where I think I'm going to cover so much material, but I never do. I don't know why I even, I guess you might be becoming fairly tired of me saying I'm not a very good time manager. It becomes really obvious. Probably isn't fair to you. We're going to try to cover a lot of material today, but I don't want to cover it in such a way that it's just a matter of information. I hope it can be relevant, and in the course of our time together, if you have any questions, I'll just ignore you, okay? you're welcome to ask, or if you have any comments. We're looking at negative emotions. Maybe some of you felt that by my being late, I don't know. I did it on purpose just to, so you could get, it was very skillful means. So. That's right, yeah. So looking at anger, attachment, jealousy, and pride. There's various listings of emotions, and there's various ways of categorizing emotions. I think according to various systems of categorization, and we're just looking at these because they're said to be primary amongst the various types of negative emotions. So setting aside the fundamental, what might be called the negative emotion, that is of ignorance, which is kind of the root of all the various other types of negative emotions that we experience. But we can deal with that kind of in and of itself. It's kind of a very big project. So, we've said that, and I'm not going to, I like to recap, I like to reinforce and go over, but there's going to be a certain amount of maybe a time element, and moreover, exposing how much I don't know about these subjects, but Buddhism is very much concerned with our basic intelligence, and sometimes when we hear the word intelligence, we think of being clever or smart in some way. But in the idea of intelligence is more in terms of not only to think clearly and think correctly, which Buddhism places a great deal of value on and emphasizes, but moreover in terms of our experience of our emotions. So in terms of our emotional intelligence, we're beginning to be able to discriminate in terms of our affective nature of our relationships, what is of benefit and what is appropriate. And being a little more skillful in how we relate with the world, and in that way, perhaps finding some way to work with our problems at a more fundamental level than maybe we normally do. So it's an educational process, education in this context, in terms of our emotions, and we've. Making a distinction between positive and negative emotions. I think it makes a difference that we do this because... Is that better? Okay. Our view, even if it's unconscious or perhaps not apparent to ourselves, around our emotions, will influence what types of emotions we cultivate consciously or unconsciously, which types of emotions we allow, give permission to find expression, are willing to express. And those emotions which we tend to restrain in some way, which we deny in some way. So we all have views around emotions. Okay, yeah, I think, is that okay now? Yeah? So it's good to clarify, and I think this it generalizes to many of the other areas of our life. We have many views which we're unconscious of, but nonetheless they're influencing how we're relating, the kinds of decisions, that where we put our energies, and so forth. And I think it's quite useful to spend time with yourself. You know, you can meditate on various subjects, but one of them is, you know, what do I actually feel about my emotions? You know, and beginning to clarify that for oneself. Because there is perhaps a distinction between, having tried to bring this out, the popular notion of emotions, and that is to say, if it feels good, do it. If it doesn't, then, you know, by all means, avoid it. And, you know, that's kind of our feel-good mentality, which we bring to our emotional repertoire in the West, I think. And I don't think that necessarily works very well, because there are many emotions which perhaps don't feel all that good, which are associated with uncomfortable feelings, but nonetheless are seen as healthy emotions, which are, you know, the one that comes to my mind is a healthy sense of regret. And compassion can be associated with the feeling of sadness. So these kind of qualities of mind aren't necessarily pleasant, and therefore for many people they're either they desensitize or numb themselves to it, or they simply seek to avoid it either consciously through suppression, or they just repress it because of their unconscious worldview or how they feel toward their emotions. So I think in education in emotions and beginning to educate ourselves, it becomes more apparent what are our views around our own emotions. I think there are some gender differences, and there's probably cultural differences in how we view emotions and what emotions are allowable and which aren't, and so forth. I think we have to get to know all of our emotions, even those emotions which perhaps aren't unskillful. At least we have to become familiar with them and their quality within our own minds. I'm not saying to express them, I'm not saying that at all, but at least begin to acknowledge them and begin to get a sense around them. In terms of a Buddhist criteria for positive and negative emotions, as I just mentioned, it's more than not just simply what is beneficial and what is appropriate. Beneficial and appropriate. The reason I say this is that, does that sound okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Beneficial is that which the criteria here is pragmatic. You know, we're not being handed some tablets down from the sky saying thou shalt do this and thou shalt not do that. There isn't that moral imperative behind what it is that we're about and the educational process that we're trying to work with. It is more in terms of utilitarianism or pragmatism. What actually works best for ourselves in beginning to free ourselves from our problems, beginning to ultimately the means of finding happiness and eliminating suffering. That's the criteria that Buddhism, I think, is using in terms of delineating the path. That which is helpful in terms of our growth, of finding more fulfillment, meaning and purpose in our life and so forth, and that which takes us or tends away from those, a quality way of life, a successful, good life for ourselves. And this usually is simply most is termed happiness and suffering, that which promotes happiness and begins to diminish our problematic approach to our life. So that which is beneficial, that which is appropriate, in a way we're talking about the same thing. When we say appropriate, we simply in keeping with the actual nature of things. I think this is a fundamental notion. You know, we can say a Buddhism, but hopefully Buddhism is describing the nature of our reality. So we don't have to put it in perhaps religious terms or spiritual terms or Buddhist terms. There's something about according with the way things actually are, which in itself is experienced as, you know, it may not be what we like. It, you know, shit happens in the world, and we have to work with that as it is. If we continually project our demand that things be other than the way they are, either consciously or in terms of our views or and these various unskillful ways of emotionally relating with the subject, with the situation, we're going to experience frustration, disappointment, discontentment, we're compounding. You know, I think there's a sutta from the Pali scriptures, and the Pali scriptures are the canon, the Buddhist canon, as is followed within the southern Buddhist countries of, you know, Sri Lanka and Burma, Thailand, Cambodia, and so forth. And it's, there's one which in which the Buddha addresses his, one of his students, and he said, "Is it painful to be shot with an arrow?" And the student, as in most of these suttas, and very clever student says, "Yes, it is painful to be shot with an arrow." And then the Buddha asks, "Is it painful to be shot? Is it even more painful to be shot with a second arrow?" And the student said, "Yes, it is." So and the Buddha said, "Well, the first arrow, you know, in life we can't control all that happens, befalls us, you know, all that happens to us. But the second arrow is optional. And the second arrow is demanding that things be other than the way they actually are. You know, we experience a sense of outrage or you know, if things aren't following our agenda, if they aren't following our particular desires and so forth, or we experience a sense of impotence and failure because we can't do the impossible. We can't change the way things actually are. We can plan to make them different in the future, that we have no choice but to relate with things as they are. If we ever, and that appropriateness in itself makes the situation even more workable. We can bring some of our own wisdom, our own skills to bear on the situation rather than compounding the problem, complicating our, you know, in terms of how we're approaching the difficulty that we're confronted with. You know, it's this, there's this sense of, you know, I'm already getting off the point, aren't I? You know, most of us are familiar with the word dukkha. Yeah, it's the term that Buddha used to describe the feeling tone of what it means to be an ordinary human being in the world, this world in which we all inhabit, where the airplanes are going over all the time. It's a wheel that originally, you know, the Buddha was something of a great, extremely skillful in linguistics. He used many of the terms, the language that was current at his time, and so that it was a familiar vocabulary, so it wasn't alien to the ear of the people he was addressing. But he began to slant, and he was very clever, he began to slant or give that term a slightly different meaning than what they had normally been used to. And he began to, in this way, he began to, as a, he began to introduce perhaps another way of thinking into their minds. So this word dukkha, it originally meant a wheel that grinds on its axle. You know, there was a misfit. Yeah, and he used this term as this very descriptive and evocative term of how we experience our daily life. You know, life kind of wears us down. It rubs up against us. You know, there's always this friction about what I want of the world and what the world is able to give me. You know? That disparity between our expectations and reality is experienced as dukkha, as frustration, as disappointment, as, you know, dissatisfaction, what we normally call suffering. So when I use this word inappropriate in describing negative emotions, one of the key marks, one of the key characteristics of all negative emotions, and that's one of the criteria that we use in determining whether an emotion is negative or positive. It has nothing to do with a moral judgment or some rules. It is whether it's appropriate, whether it's in keeping with the actual nature of the object. And one of the characteristics that we looked at in terms of the first of these four negative emotions that we're working with, that we're looking at, that is, say, anger, or hatred, or hostility, is that it always exaggerates the negative quality of its object. And this is going to be true for all the various negative emotions. They're never quite accurate in terms of the measure of how they're viewing the object. And therefore, our actions on how we approach it are never quite in accordance with the actual nature of what is the most effective. That, you know, we keep continually making messes and having to clean up the messes that we're continually making. You know, it's this self-reinforcing loop that we're all involved in. You know, these cycles of dissatisfaction, having to keep involving ourselves in corrective actions to correct the actions that, in the mistakes that we've done in the past. And it's a never-ending process. So one is that it's beneficial in the sense that it helps to liberate us from our problems rather than perpetuating our problems. That's the criteria. And the other is that these are a positive and discriminating between positive and negative emotions, that they're appropriate. They're in keeping with the actual nature of the object. So and we've talked about in the nature of anger is that it perpetuates our problems and our difficulties with regard to the object, but moreover, it is inappropriate in that it's exaggerating the negative qualities of the object. And it and therefore, any type of remedy that we try to, any kind of adjustment, any type of response, is somehow not quite hitting the mark. Okay, so we've gone through, we've talked about the nature of anger. You remember, okay? I don't want to spend too much on anger, but I don't want you to get angry at me. There's an unattractive object. You know, there's lots of, it's very rich. And the way we can begin to deconstruct these emotions is an unattractive object. Well, why is that? We could begin by asking, well, why is that object unattractive to you? And then, you know, we could talk about that. And we've touched upon that. Moreover, then one begins to exaggerate that unattractive nature of that object. So why do we exaggerate that, you know? And then one becomes antagonistic, and out of that arises essentially most a wish to harm. That's one aspect, but I don't want to limit it to just that. One doesn't want that object there, or this situation there, or this circumstance there. It's like you come home and there's a pile of dirty dishes. You don't want them there. You know, I want the house to be clean. It's not clean. You know, there's this disparity between what I want and what is. And how are you going to relate with that? You might relate with it aggression, hostility. You know, it would be wrong to say, I wish to hurt the dishes. You just, you know, that doesn't make any sense. But you simply don't want this present situation to be as it is, and there's a sense of aggressive quality to it, and an inappropriate response in terms of the actual measure of what's there. There's an exaggerated quality in terms of its negative impact on you. The mind is imbalanced with regard to that. So that's what, you know, we're talking about this quality of mind when we talk about anger. So you can be angry. You can be angry at yourself, even an idea in your own mind. You know, people get, you know, it happens a lot. We talked about how to. Okay. We've talked about working with anger. I like to. Yeah. I don't want to digress too much. I will digress just a little bit. I don't want us to. You know, there is, and maybe I'm taking a chance here. Maybe I'm putting myself out on a limb, and maybe, you know, by all means, take what I say with them. You know, a couple kilos of salt, but a grain of salt at least, and you can make use of it. I don't think we should set up an aggressive quality or set up a sense of struggle with our emotions, even with the negative emotions. I'm not saying, you know, to indulge your negative emotions, but I don't think it is of use to set up an antagonism. Sometimes some of the vocabulary of Buddhism tends toward a sense of we're doing battle within our own minds. You know, we use this term like anarhat is coming from the Tibetan etymology of Dra Trampa, is translated as foe destroyer. Yeah, so we're really, you know, this is the enemy, I'm going to kill it. You know, I think I'm not sure. I'm sort of over the years, kind of. I'm not saying I'm befriending my anger, but I no longer have a sense of. I want to get to know my enemy, or I want to become. Maybe my anger is misunderstood. You know, these demons. I'm reminded of the story that Milarepa, when he was, Milarepa was one of the great yogis of Tibet. Is one of the most admired practitioners from the point of view that he was in his childhood. He and his mother were thought to have been cheated out of their family inheritance by their relatives, and so he practiced black magic, and he went on to kill, I think, maybe 30 or 35 of his relatives. You know, which is pretty heavy. But nonetheless, at a certain point in his, he developed a great deep sense of regret for having done what he did, and he went on to engage in practice, spiritual practice, and he achieved Buddhahood within that very lifetime. So that's why he's so greatly admired and held up as an example of the possibilities that one can go from a murderer to a saint. To a Buddha, if you like. But my point in bringing him up is that he was in a cave in the mountains of Tibet, and he came back, he was out collecting, he lived on nettles. Sometimes he's pictured green, he used to eat nettles all the time. Anyway, and he came back to his cave, and there were all these demons. Whether they were demons or not, I don't know. But that's not the important, part of the story. There were these forces, these negative forces, which were harassing him, undermining his ability to carry on his practice the way he thought it should go, and they were hindrance. They were interfering, and he tried everything to get rid of these demons, and they would just keep harassing him and obstructing his practice. And finally, he said, "I give in. Take me if you want." He quit resisting. He opened up. He began to look at what are they all about? And in that very process, they went away. They were no longer problematic for him. So, in talking about all of these various negative, what we call negative emotions, anger, attachment, we've gone through some of the disadvantages of anger, for example, and there are tremendous disadvantages to them. So I'm not suggesting that you cultivate anger, but I am suggesting that you get to know your anger. That you even, for some people, they don't even want to know they're angry. They even deny their anger. Yeah? Especially for long-time Buddhist practitioners, it's like a failure. I must be a failure if I'm angry. And that they feel there's something wrong with. I've been practicing all this time, talking about bodhicitta and talking about in the awakened heart and compassion for all sentient beings, and here I'm still getting uptight with this, driving down the street. I'm a failure. I think if we're going to learn about anger, we have to be aware of it and acknowledge it, and get to know of it. I'm not saying indulge it, but indulge in it by any means. Express it by any means. I'm not saying that at all. But we have to get, because maybe, once we get to know anger, we'll become more skillful around it with regards to it. Anger is a learned repertoire of relating. It's a composite of mental elements which we've developed over time. And it serves some purpose. Maybe it hasn't served our purpose well. But it was developed as a way to protect ourselves. Maybe there was nothing there to protect in the first place, but nonetheless, or maybe it's outserved its purpose, or maybe it's being used inappropriately, and we've nuanced the qualities of anger. You know what I mean by that is, there were areas that could come under the umbrella of anger, which perhaps don't belong all there. I mean by that assertiveness, setting boundaries, working against injustice. You know, it can be very, very forceful. There's a lot of, the world needs to change in some constructive way, and that requires some kind of energy. And that energy, we might associate with anger. And if we're never willing to get in touch with that energy and begin to analyze it and understand, begin to discriminate between, setting boundaries, assertiveness, righting wrongs in the world, then we're going to be like a little bit of Melba toast. We're going to be disengaged from the world. We won't have that willingness to become involved, because we repress that very quality which helps to energize ourselves and motivate ourselves to I don't think the Buddha was a wimp. So I think we have to get to know anger, and I think therefore we have to not be so afraid of it. I'm taking a chance on saying that. I realize that it could be taken wrongly, but nonetheless I think it's, if we get to know anger, we maybe will see something about it. Maybe we'll see some sadness, some hurt underneath the anger. Maybe we'll see that what we call anger, I was so angry for the last 5 minutes. Or maybe we're just rehearsing some scenarios about what we would have liked to have said, or the way things would have gone, or the disappointments we feel, or the hurts begin to deconstruct it, and we begin to understand where we're coming from, and maybe we can take better care of our minds, working at a deeper, where that anger is coming from, rather than simply denying it or repressing it, or being aggressive toward it. So we've looked at some of what I call working with anger. We can work out with the process of working with mindfulness. We can do a reality check. Is it really the way I'm looking at it? Remember, there's always this exaggerated quality to all the negative emotions. So bringing the mind back to a balanced state, seeing the positive qualities. There's no one who is as horrible as the object of our anger. That person doesn't exist. The object of our negative emotion only exists in our head. It doesn't exist out there. And becoming more familiar with that, so we don't necessarily buy into the scenario. The mind is, I want to talk more about that, especially when we come to attachment, so I'm going to work through this. These are some things that we covered last time. Developing, meditating on loving kindness, which is the direct antidote to, love most essentially is to wish that others be happy. Hatred and hostility is the wish that another suffer. So they're mutually contradictory. So as one develops, the other will lessen quite naturally. Developing empathy, putting ourselves in another's place. This is really one of the, I think, a key quality in being able to get by better in our relationships with others, is the ability to look at other people's, look at the world, the situation, out of other people's eyes. What is the exact opposite is what we call sociopath. A sociopath has an inability to be able to understand the consequences of their actions on others. They're not aware of the impact in terms of how other people might be feeling for what they're doing. So the opposite of that, of a sociopath, is to develop a sense of empathy. And by that, Is this interesting? I don't know. We're going on it. You know, we train in empathy, a great part of the path. You know, it's a doorway into compassion. And, you know, being able, let's say, we can't quite know how the other person is experiencing what they're going through. It's like, you know, someone trying to convey to you what brown sugar tastes like. Yeah? Maybe you've never tasted brown sugar. But you can have a sense. Well, so maybe somebody just lost their child. And I've never lost a child. I couldn't even begin, but I can begin to imagine what that must feel. So, because why? Because I can go back to my own repertoire of experiences over the course of my life, and I can find maybe something which is even slightly similar. You know, I lost my parents or something like that, and how did that feel for me? Yeah, and then I can begin to modify in my imagination how their particular context, you know, and I can begin to modify in my imagination what, you know, how that context for them is being played out in terms of their inner felt experience. I haven't lost a child, but I've lost a parent. But I know how, you know, I can begin to use my imagination to take what I do know in terms of my own repertoire of past experiences and begin to make a composite of, well, I know what it is to have lost a parent, or I know what I've talked to other people. And so we begin to feel our way into their subjective experience. There's a difference between identifying with and empathizing. In empathizing, I'm using my own parallel experience, similitudes of experience, and getting a sense of what they must be feeling like. If they tell me, I've never tasted brown sugar, but I've tasted white sugar. And maybe I can, in my mind, I can add a little bit of this or a little bit of that, a little bit of maple syrup or something like that, or molasses, and that's probably what it tastes like. So I can get a sense, and then I understand. To understand is to love. Love is to understand. It's just like almost, this is the affective and cognitive aspects of the same experience in a way. So we get a sense of what they're, and we begin to enter into their subjective experience, what they must become, and we understand them, and we can begin to act appropriately. What would you want if you were in their situation? What would you need? And you open yourself up to that and respond. As opposed to when you identify and you lose, you take on their emotional reaction. If somebody's feeling anxious, you begin to feel anxious yourself. You know, the person is undergoing something about, maybe they're going to have to give a talk on Saturday afternoon at the VI, you know? and they're feeling apprehensive, but they're also beginning to panic, feeling fear, anxiety. And you begin, so you might, well, I've given talks in the past, I know, that can be scary. You know? But with identity, you begin to actually panic yourself. You begin to become a little shaky. And, you know, you're not of much use to either, to them or yourself, when you're in such a context. Anyway, I'm getting off the subject again. How did I, So my point is that with one of the antidotes, one of the ways of working with anger is to beginning to empathize, to understand where this person is coming from in terms of, and we do this by relating it back to our similitudes or parallel experiences that we've had in the course of our life, even though it may be quite different. It's probably we've never experienced quite the same, but we can begin to approach it at least, and we begin to feel our way in. then we focus upon the kindness of others. And then, you know, both in terms of, you know, it's apparent of those who are our friends, and that's why they're our friends, more or less, because we are aware, or we're conscious of their kindnesses that they do show us. But we went on, you can cultivate a sense of kindness of others in terms of when they're neutral, when they're strangers. And we talked about that. And, you know, all that we have is very much dependent upon others. You know, all that we derive pleasure, all that we value, the very fact that we were able to come here and have this this opportunity and this luxury of that, you know, this high standard of living and so forth that we all experience is very much dependent upon people who we will never know. And whatever helps us, we're benefited in that way. Then the kindness of enemies. So various ways of some of the antidotes that we've looked at in terms of anger. I'd like to just take up one more. Well, actually, there's two more antidotes or ways of working with anger. And I very much appreciate that the complexity and the subtlety of some of these issues, and I have a tremendous respect for other people's emotional experiences, and I wouldn't like to oversimplify them or discount them. So why am I, you know, I'm prefacing what I'm going to say, because I'm going to want to talk about forgiveness with regard to hatred and anger, forgiving that person. And, you know, this is not an easy issue. You know, there's some, maybe, and I respect that, but I think it's worth at least talking about, and it's worth at least reflecting upon. You know, maybe we can't begin to forgive. Maybe it's not appropriate at this present time. And I wouldn't want you to pressure yourself into thinking that you should. Not at all. But just to look at it. And maybe something naturally will evolve out of that. So I'm talking about forgiveness as a way of working with anger or hatred or hostility that we might feel. So in talking about forgiveness does not mean we forget. You know, that everything is okay now. It doesn't have anything to do with that. You know, that it's not a misguided effort to suppress or ignore our pain. You know, the pain. We're not doing this to get rid of our pain. We're doing this most basically to help ourselves. We're not doing it for the other person. Yeah. So. We try to understand all that's the near and far conditions which have brought about this present circumstance, this past incident, this suffering which we're involved in. You know, what's happened? Things still may need to be worked out. You know, things still may need to be set right. Though we forgive, we might understand that things can never go back to the way they were. You know, that maybe it's in the case of, say, you and another person, or myself and another person, that maybe we shouldn't relate in the same way that we did in the past. You know, maybe it's best that we go our separate ways, even. Or I'm not going to ever allow this to happen to me again. That's fine. You can make those kinds of determinations. Never again. So forgiving is not forgetting. Forgiving is letting go of the hostility, the resentment that we feel. You know, letting go of this of wanting to retaliate, to hurt back. You know, we're letting go of the grievance. I was looking at the word this morning on Wikipedia, the relationship between the word grief and grievance. Grievance according to the Wikipedia, is the cause of grief. There's a relationship. And the grievance comes from the word, is a Dutch word. It means the same thing as grief. As long as we hold that grief, that grievance, we're holding on to our grief, the pain. You know, we may feel betrayed. We may feel that, you know, somehow we've been treated unfairly. Somebody's done something wrong to ourselves. But we're working with letting go of the desire to hurt back, the desire to retaliate. So forgiveness, and this isn't original what I'm going to say, but I think it's something useful to think about. Forgiveness means giving up the hope for a better past, giving up the hope that the past could be different, and moving on in our life. Yeah. It would have been nice if what happened hadn't happened, but it did. That's reality. And we have to begin to accept that and find some way to accommodate that emotionally in our life, if we're ever going to move on, if we're going to stop twisting the knife in our heart, holding that grievance, which is the source of grief for ourselves. So forgiveness is the price that we pay for freedom. Such that we don't, you know, the only dangerous thing about our past is when it becomes our future. You know, when we carry it around on our backs, and it begins to determine how we relate with the world and our future events. Then it becomes a real threat to our well-being in the future. We can't help in the past. So, you know, as I have tremendous respect. You know, what do you do if your child was murdered? What do you do with that? You know, you may live that with you the rest of your life. So, I'm very cautious and respectful when I talk in these ways. But it's, at least we can begin to consider it. For example, you know, what the our grief or our forgiveness. You know, it has many parts. There's some kind of maybe disappointments or feeling of being misunderstood or being treated unfairly or being betrayed. So what I'm saying is maybe we can find some way, a part of that. There's an aspect. You know, we take these emotions as if they were solid, homogeneous mass. Oh, but in fact, they have many various elements. And we can begin, you know, they're a composite of lots of little bits. And maybe we can begin to find some way of entering into forgiveness from some direction, from some means. Other avenues aren't available to ourselves. Maybe we can begin to understand where this person's coming from. Maybe we can begin to, you know, soften our heart in certain ways. I think it's worthwhile. Why? Not for the benefit of that person that you're holding the grievance toward, but for yourself. And that's why you're doing it. Yeah. And not to please God, not to please our teachers, but to release your heart. You know, this, what we carry, in this pain that we carry around in terms of our grievance. So, you know, also we have to, and this is can associate, and I think it's an important aspect we have to consider, is we also have to do a lot of forgiving toward ourselves. And maybe some people haven't, maybe we haven't thought about that toward ourselves. A lot of us are angry at ourselves in various ways. You know, for the hurt that we may have caused others in the past, or for making some bad choices in the course of our life, or for letting ourselves down, or maybe letting somebody we care for down in some way. And we carry a grudge against ourselves. We feel guilty. We don't feel good about ourselves. We have to even forgive ourselves. You know, we're ordinary human beings trying the best we can. And we make lots of mistakes. And sometimes we're harder on ourselves than we are on other people. And how do we begin to forgive ourselves for the mistakes that we made? You know, maybe we handled some kinds of situations poorly in the past. Okay. We're not that same person any longer. Maybe we didn't have the presence of mind. Maybe there were influences which we can't even remember that we were under the force of at that time. We weren't thinking clearly. All kinds of possibilities. we have to be we have to extend that same compassion toward ourselves as we might for others. Perhaps even more so, if we're going to begin to extend compassion for others, it's very much a reflection about how we treat ourselves, how we relate with ourselves, how we relate with others, how we treat others. So working with forgiving ourselves. And then finally, one of another antidote or way of working with anger can be extended to all the various negative emotions and so forth, is beginning to look at the I. You know, normally, especially in an emotional situation, we are focused, all our attention is toward the object. You lousy, rotten, no good, you know. So in the course of our strong emotions, we keep bringing the object to mind. It keeps triggering some kind of spark, and we reignite this emotional reaction. Here, we can begin to pay attention to, become aware of the subject of the emotional experience. You know, who is it that's so angry? I can't stand you. You know, what is the nature of that I? Rather than concentrating on I can't stand you, you know, and building this big story around that you, we begin to refocus our attention. Who is the I that can't do that standing? Who's the I that's so upset? Who's the I that's at the center, at the kernel of this huge story that you're building up around that? So this is kind of the really fundamental antidote or way of working with all the negative emotions, beginning to investigate the nature of the self, the nature of the I, which is at the root. We have some kind of misconceptions around that. Beginning to observe the subject of our experience. Okay, so those are some of the ways we can work with anger. I'd like to go on. Any points you'd like to make around some of what I've covered? It's been a kind of a... bringing lots of threads in quite quickly. I'm aware. Attachment, okay? So again, it's a mental factor, and as was in the case of anger, there is an exaggeration. But here, the exaggeration is in terms of not depreciation, but in terms of overestimating the attractiveness of the object. There's an attractive object. We overestimate or we exaggerate that attractive nature of the object, and we go on to you know, and this, the object might be a person, it might be a thing, it might be an idea, it might be a feeling, it might be a reputation, it could be almost anything, and we wish to possess it, we wish to make it mine, you know, and the desired object, you know, I think I've mentioned, and this, you know, the Buddha said that we filter all our experiences through three basic misperceptions, that we hold that which is impermanent as permanent, and that which we hold the things about us as able to bring complete satisfaction, and that which is without self as being a self or having a self. So these are all going to, these become very, we can begin to see how these are working, especially with anger, but with all the negative emotions, the afflictive emotions. So we want to possess it. We want to hold on to it. We want to incorporate it into our sense of our own identity, our sense of self, to bring it on this side of the boundary. It's out there. It's attractive. The mind becomes unbalanced. It exaggerates the positive quality or the attractive quality. It filters out any negative aspects. You know, the Tibetans have a saying, "In a lover's cup is never dirty." When in the throes, you know, it's like when you're like romantic love is a great example. You know, how much projection there is, but it's going on in the case of all desirous attachment. like after 6 months of you fall in love. After about 6 months, one partner says to the other, "You know, you're not quite the person I thought you were." Well, they never were. You know, there has to be at some point, if you're going to get in, if you're going to move on to actually beginning to love a real human being, that necessarily involves a stage of disillusionment, where you begin to withdraw your projections. That person can no longer sustain your projections which you've been placing upon them. No one could. No real person could. Only a fantasized possibility. So with regard to attachment, there is a sense of wanting either to come in contact with the object or maintain contact with the object or to repeat contact in the object again in the future in some way. So it involves the idea, the sense that get across here is it involves a sense of getting stuck or fixated on something. The mind has difficulty in letting go and moving on. You know, for example, you know, it could be a strong desire for delicious food, or it could be the mindless allegiance to a political party, or even a religious ideology. You can be attached to your religion, as Lama Yeshe would say, or you can be attached to your own nose. You know, the object of attachment is always exaggerated in terms of its agreeable quality, and there's its ability. And this is the important point. Its ability to bring us happiness. And its disagreeable qualities are being filtered out. So, typically in traditional Buddhism, there are various terms which we make use of, which are more or less synonymous, but we could tease them out, but we won't. You know, attachment, craving, greed, desire, thirst, clinging, they have nuances of difference in meaning, but generally we're talking about these qualities of mind. So whether it be clinging to or attachment to or craving to a person or money or possessions and so forth, there always has a sense of overestimating the attractive nature of the object. So sometimes when people initially come in contact with Buddhism, Westerners, they become confused around the fact that we're advised to give up attachment, or we're advised to give up craving, or we're advised to give up clinging, that maybe what is being said here is that we should abandon or give up all wanting at all, or that we can't have what we might call reasonable desires. Or, you know, we should give up all motivated activities altogether. You know, we shouldn't have preference. Some people develop these kinds of notions. So, Buddha, this is my own. You know, I might be talking from my own neurosis here. So, by all means, take that in consideration. Buddhist teachings do not suggest that we are to give up wanting, or to give up desire or intentional actions. You know, we all desire to be happy. We desire not to suffer. That's quite a legitimate desire. It's quite reasonable. We have every right to try to pursue that desire. That's why we're here. So what the teachings are suggesting is that we give up our fixated adhesion, that we give up our unreflected clinging to things or our ideas. So, you know, so Buddhism is asking us to diminish our driven, compulsive, stuck forms of wanting, not wanting in general. You know, what we're trying to do is, if we use another word which is very evocative, but which makes sense, we're trying to give up our addictions, you know, essentially. So, the key, I think, is why is it so difficult for us to have a sense of like a Teflon, a stick free of way of relating, as opposed to, you know, a Velcro you know, which gets hooked on everything. You know, it's a, you know, it's like I, you know, one image that comes to my mind when I think of this in this way is that, you know, you go to an art gallery and you really enjoy these beautiful paintings. It's a beautiful day. Oh, it's so beautiful. And you just, okay. And you walk away from feeling enriched by that experience. But you don't want to, you know, I'm going to take, I have to, you know, some maybe, a few people say, I have to have that hanging in my living room or I'll never be happy again. And that. So one, you just simply, you know, it's like, I wish I had it. Maybe I do. No, I don't have it. There's a beautiful verse by, he who kisses at, he who kisses the joy as it flies lives in eternity sunrise. I can't remember it. I wish I wouldn't have started that. There's nothing wrong with enjoying. We should all be blissed out now. So, but the problem is the difference between a Teflon approach, where it doesn't, you know, thinks we can move on. We feel enriched. We can feel it was a beautiful experience. We don't try to haul the past along with us, as opposed to a Velcro approach to our experiences, where we try to, you know, we get hooked on in some way. We want to drag it into the future with ourselves. We want to maintain contact and repeat contact again in the future. So also, there's a notion, and it's a very interesting notion. It's something I read recently. This, that trying to fulfill our desires or a desirous attachment always involves disappointment. Why? Because the thing is not real enough in itself to bring us complete satisfaction of what we're looking to that object to give us. Why? Because we are, just as I mentioned with the Buddha, he said that we're always projecting or we're always filtering our experiences through these three basic misperceptions. One of them is permanence. And you see something beautiful and you have a sense that would always be there for you if you could own it. That beauty and that ability to bring you pleasure is a permanent, unchanging aspect, nature. This is what attachment is built on. If there's a certain internal logic to attachment, if things were permanent, then attachment would make great sense. You know, hold on to it by all means. Keep it with you. And moreover, this other aspect of you know, self. But here something a little more deeper. In the sense that we believe that the object, the way it's appearing to us, it has a nature which is, it has ability by way of its very nature to bring us happiness. And you see a beautiful, for me, a lovely woman's body, and it seems like it's like almost radiating a desirability. I can bring you bliss, I can bring you pleasure. It seems as if that's in the very nature of the object. And so my wanting it, my desirous attachment, wanting to hold on to it, in that context makes a lot of sense. You know, if things were, you know, we have this saying in the West, don't we? Beauty is in the eyes of the beholder. And we thought, oh, yeah, that makes sense. But the moment we become have an emotional experience, that logic, that reasonableness goes out the window. Beauty is not in the eyes of the beholder. Beauty is in the object itself. That desirable nature is in the object itself. It has nothing to do with my thinking of it as such. But it is if only I could have that object, it would permanently and by way of its own nature be able to bring me bliss. I could keep it in my little pouch here, and I could snack from it anytime I wanted a bit of bliss. It's in its very nature. It doesn't matter how my mind is feeling, what's going on for me, the context. It would always be there, and it would always be in the nature of being able to bring me bliss. I better hold on to that. I mean, if that were the case, I would hold on to it. But it's not the case, isn't it? Sometimes, you know, I don't know if you've ever had in your relationships, you know, there's someone you love very deeply, someone that can bring you great happiness. Sometimes it's a pain in the ass. Sometimes it's very difficult. And that's the nature of it. Anything other than that is your projections, your fantasy. It's not in the nature of the object. It's not permanent. And moreover, it's not able to bring you complete satisfaction. It's like if we try to there's always this disparity. The object, we have a sense that the object is reliable. It's by possessing it, by owning it, by having it, by acquiring it, by identifying with it, by associating with it, it's going to bring me the happiness I want. It's going to bring, there's this craving, and there's a sense of it's going to completely satisfy my desiring. But what happens? We get the object. The very fact of desire or attachment is experienced as tension, as stressful. The more stress, the release from that stress is experienced as pleasure, as bliss. Yeah? But that bliss is not, cannot, the object cannot sustain that. We have to begin all over again. The hunger starts all over again. The search starts all over again. We have to go through the same process, forever consuming. More and more, trying to find that one thing in our life, in the things about us, that we're looking for, which is going to bring us that permanent state of bliss that we're all searching for in one way or another. And we keep searching, looking, in this dissatisfied thirst. And we never find, in the picture, in the photograph. There's always this disparity. There's a saying. There are two great tragedies. There are two great disappointments in life. One is not getting what you want, and the other is getting what you want. You know, we never quite get what it is that we hoped, that we looked to that object to bring us, in terms of our attachment, in terms of our desire, and so forth, our clinging, our thirst. Another point I want to make is that the opposite of attachment is what I'm, and this maybe is just a sense of vocabulary or just terminology, but so we want to go beyond that. I want to get across the sense of what I'm making here rather than get hung up on the terms. But the opposite of attachment is non-attachment, and is not what I call detachment. So I just want to, we could use different terms, but the meaning is what is important here, and I'm going to try to explain what I mean by that. Is that non-attachment, by that I mean, is a release of fixation. It's a more fluid, open way of relating. Okay? Whereas detachment is emotional distance, an absence of commitment. So it would be a mistake to confuse engaged non-attachment, where you're really working towards something, but you have but you're fluid in how you go about whether you achieve that end or not. You aren't fixated upon it, but you're still committed. You're doing your best you can. So you're engaging with a sense of non-attachment. There would be a great mistake to confuse this engaged non-attachment with defensive detachment. And what I mean by that is where the individual is disengaged and may lack any desires at all, any strong feelings toward anything at all. You know, non-attachment is a way of relating, a skillful way of relating. Detachment is a way of withdrawing from the world and giving up on the world. So when we talk about non-attachment, we're not talking about giving up on the world and running away from the world or withdrawing from the world. We're talking about a particular skillful way of relating. It is a type of way, it's a way of relating, not a way of withdrawing. Sometimes I think that we have to make that little nuance. Some people are just simply, some people who simply cannot engage in the world for one reason or another, this can be mistaken for a sense of the quality of non-attachment. And it has nothing to do with non-attachment. They don't have the choice. They don't have the freedom. They don't have the ability to engage if they prefer to. they are lacking the ability to make a commitment to their kind of objective reality in any way. So that's not what we mean by non-attachment. It is a more fluid, open, balanced way of relating with objects and people and so forth. So we can talk about, does that make sense? Yeah. Quite confronting. Is detachment? Yeah, that's good. The question to look at that. Yeah. It's a mixture. I don't know. Then, as we did with anger, you know, we want to develop. You know, if you're genuinely going to work with the emotions, it's necessary that you create the context whereby which allows for the changes that we want to bring about. We have to begin to create a platform from which to approach the working with the emotions, and that platform is beginning to see within our own experience whether this emotion is in our best interest or is not working in our best interest. Whether it's, what are the advantages and disadvantages of this emotion? You know, for some reason we have this emotion. In a evolutionary wise, it has served some purpose for ourselves. It wouldn't be there if it didn't. No, we don't have superfluous emotions. They have in the past served ourselves. They may not be serving ourselves well in the present. But they did serve. We can be assured of that. And we have to begin to question, what are the disadvantages and advantages of this particular emotion? There's also a resistance to change. Change only comes about when there's a certain genuine feeling of necessity to bring about these changes. If it's simply a matter of speculation or curiosity, wouldn't it be nice if I were a loving, kind, generous person? That probably isn't enough. It might be a pleasant thought, it might be even a sincere thought. But we have to see that at a very basic level, that I'm hurting myself by continuing in this fashion. And I can help myself by diminishing it in my life. So we look at, so this acts as the platform for working with the emotions, and for all of the emotions. Any kind of change that you want to make, it seems like as if it's the foundation for change. What are the advantages and disadvantages? What are the advantages if I change? What are the disadvantages if I don't change? You know, we have some kind of emotional investment in keeping this current thing going. And to begin to interrupt that flow of the past into the future requires some degree of... intervention requires a great deal of motivation, a great deal of intentionality. And this, we have to want it. So, looking at some of the disadvantages of attachment, and when we talked about anger, we did a little bit of an exercise, didn't we? On the whiteboard. What are the advantages of anger? There are advantages to anger. There are apparent short-term advantages to anger. I don't think we can deny that. I don't think, you just can't dismiss it. It wouldn't be, you get angry people get what they want. Yeah? They get the line first. I want to be first. Wait a minute. Oh. So we have to begin to look, what is the overall quality of life that we're creating for ourselves? Get some perspective. Then we can begin to question, maybe my initial, what I want initially, my, you know, gratification of my immediate desires, maybe that would be nice. But but what are the long-term consequences of that? You know, it's like kids, when they drop out of high school or something because they want a car. You know, they get some job at McDonald's, turning hamburgers. And they do. They get their car. But what are but where is that going to take them in terms of their overall quality of their life? 50 years from now, they want to still be flipping hamburgers at McDonald's. So there are certain advantages in terms of immediate gratification of fulfilling desires. So, okay, we have to acknowledge that, and we have to begin to then we have to refute those in terms of a bigger picture that we want for ourselves. It's like, that's what we call maturity, isn't it? Someone who's willing to forego short-term gratification, immediate gratification for longer-term goals. So this extends to all of these various attachments and so forth, but all the emotions, any type of change that you want to make. Looking at both the advantages and the disadvantages and seeing if you can refute the supposed or the assumed advantages. If you can't, well, maybe you should hang on to it, because you probably will. So looking at some of the disadvantages of attachment, if we had more time, we could, that's actually what I was planning on doing, but what are some of the disadvantages of attachment? Anybody? I'm doing all the talking here. Dependency. So dependency is not a good thing. Do you mind if I inquire with you around it? I'm putting you on the spot, maybe. Do you depend upon your car to get you to work? So is that dependency a bad thing? It could be. What makes it? What would be the criteria for whether it was a good thing or a bad thing? That dependency. It narrows your options. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's great. So there's certain. So those types of dependencies which begin to narrow down our freedom or options, those are disadvantageous to ourselves. Yeah, that's good. Any other? Please.
It can bring you unhappiness.
How?
Because what you are attached to doesn't give you what you want. Say, for example, I'm attached to my daughter and I don't get love back from her, that expect the love of.
So, so your attachment.
You have expectation.
Okay. Okay.
And when your expectation isn't fulfilled, yeah.
Yeah, good one. Yeah, excellent. So, attachment comes with certain expectations that what we're going to get from that object, your daughter, for example. And when you don't get that, it hurts. Yeah. That's quite true. Any other? Just kind of. Pardon?
Obsessive.
Could you give me an example around that? Minds out of balance, yeah, and you become kind of, as you used it, that's a good word, obsessed with, you become very narrowed down, focused, and you may be neglecting other areas. Okay, good. I think, yeah, that's what we, I've got a few here I can share with you, but I think this would be a really important step that's necessary to work to go through in developing them. Working with, for example, attachment, and, you know, it, looking at both the advantages and disadvantages, and you know, of all the what the problems that it does cause us, and so forth. I'd like to just mention some of the antidotes. So, using that as a platform, looking at the disadvantages and advantages, then we can begin to actually look at apply some of the various types of antidotes. One way is, you know, we just said that the mind is unbalanced. It is focusing, it is filtering out the negative qualities and exaggerating the positive qualities. So one way, one simple way, is to bring the mind back to a balanced state. That is to say, take to mind or consciously pay attention to a negative quality of the object. Yeah. You know, this notion, attention is reality, what we pay attention to. That becomes our reality. So most of the time, what we pay attention to is under the control of unconscious habit. So here, we're in the case of working with, in the context of working with the attachment, we are consciously, purposely looking, trying to way to bring the mind back to balance, and just simply paying attention to some negative quality. You know, this is you know, traditionally this is very much a one example. It's applied to is if you have sexual attachments and so forth. You know, we have compulsions around and begin to look at some of the negative qualities of the object and so forth. We also said that one of the fundamental underpinnings is that we hold the object to be permanent. We always think it's going to be there. We won't try to hold on to an object if we are aware, if we're mindful that it's impermanent. Is it, you know, the whole, even the very the approach of attachment is, I can keep that object forever. It would make no sense, even if to try to hold on to an impermanent object. You know you're going to be you're setting yourself up for disappointment, frustration, to try to hold on to an impermanent object. As long as you're thinking, you know, we can hold, you know, at one level you can understand, this object is impermanent. At another level, you can be holding that object as being permanent. And this is the level from which, you know, upon which attachment is arising. So we have to bring our understanding that this object is impermanent as a means for to refute that fundamental notion, you know, part of our worldview, that this object is permanent. And therefore, this can act as an antidote. One of the necessary conditions for attachment to arise is holding the object as being permanent. So, looking at the impermanence of the object, we can remember, you know, for example, death. Whatever it might be, we're going to have to let go of it eventually. We have no choice in the matter. I mean, it's not a, perhaps a very pleasant thought, but nonetheless, it's part of our reality. We can mentally dissect the object. What is it about the object that it's so desirable? What is it that it seems like it's as if it were coming from its own side, its own very nature? We can do a reality check. Is that object in the very, does it exist in the way that it's appearing to me, the way that I'm grasping at it? So there's just some of the ways that we can begin to look at attachment in general. And then there are, I'll just finish attachment. If you're not too attached, we're going to take a break. Okay. We can look at attachment to praise. This is a big one. Yeah? some antidotes to working with attachment to praise. For example, thinking that whatever the praise is being directed toward you is being directed toward that person behind you, something like that. Or maybe, you know, if you have your spiritual teacher, you can that the praise is being directed toward your spiritual teacher, that you maybe visualize at your heart. Who they're actually talking about is not you, but they're talking about your spiritual teacher. You know? It's a fantastic talk jhampa, you know. They're not really talking about me. So I don't take it on in that way. When somebody praises you, you can be sure. And this is my own experience, which I've gone through quite a lot. That somebody else is going to criticize you for the same thing. What do we pay attention to? We like to hold on to just that. So also due to, and this is an important one, I think in our everyday relationships, due to our attachment to others' approval, you begin to lose your freedom. This is something that you mentioned. You lose your freedom and cease to make wise choices. If you are attached to being approved by others, to others liking you, you no longer are using. You first off, you begin to narrow down your own freedom, but moreover, you no longer access your own wisdom. What's right? Because it may provoke disapproval from others, and that's the one thing you don't want. You want to remain attached. You don't have a life when you perform for others. When the overall force of the nature of your relationship is simply having to be pleasing to others, to get approval for others to like you. Your life becomes something of a performance. It may not actually touch where you're actually at in terms of how you actually feel. You know, people are fickle. And I get this all the time. And it's over the years of speaking in this way. You know, some people, after talk, wow, fantastic. Greatest talk I've ever heard, you know, greatest thing since sliced bread, you know, or whatever. And then, you know, and then a couple weeks later you see them and you say, oh, I'm not coming to your talks anymore. There's this crystal therapy, which we're getting in touch with the cosmos. And it's fantastic. You should come along. If you live by the sword, you die by the sword. If you're going to attach to that kind of praise, your mind's going to just go up and down, just like a roller coaster. So you have to begin to, if you don't want the, if you can't stand the lows, then don't, you have to give up being so attached to the highs when other people praise you, for example. You can be sure. Sometimes, and this is quite often the case, they praise you for qualities that you don't even have. We know for ourselves. You know, I come here and talk in the ways I do, and some people think, oh, I must be really wise and kind. He must be a very loving person. I want it to be wonderful to live with him. Well, just ask my partner, Betsy. You know, she'll tell you a different story completely. You know, I can be very angersome, I can be very narrow-minded, but I try to put on a good front for you, you know. And that's all you see. So then there's also, and I'm going to stop here, but just maybe you guys aren't into this sexual attachment. I don't know. It can be problematic, that we never... maybe it's more of a problem for young people. Oh, most of you are young. Okay, not for us. I remember back in the horse and buggy days when I was courting. Anyway, you get sexual attachment really gets in the way of actually getting to know a person. The intimate. You know, we all crave intimacy. We want to get close to people, don't we? And what quite often happens, and I think this is maybe this is even more pr- pertinent for men, the intimacy goes off into, rather than emotional intimacy, it goes off into a sexual intimacy. It veers off. And we begin to mistake sexual intimacy for emotional intimacy. But quite often they have nothing to do with one another. Yeah? So it does, this attachment to the sexual relations prevents us from really getting to know each other. I mean, I'm talking about, you know, a couple and so forth. Maybe not in this context that we're sharing here. So, you know, I think it's, I mean, this is my experience. And, being preoccupied in that way when you meet someone. I'm talking about when I was younger. Maybe we grow out of it, I don't know. Anyway, and then of course, like we were just saying, you know, that you can strip away in this. There's some engaging in the Bodhisattva's way of life by Shantideva, goes, you know, peeling away the skin, looking at the organs, and I don't know if that works all that well, but anyway, you could. That's a way of. Anyway, the point is to look at some of the negative aspects of the sexually attractive object, to bring the mind into balance. Yeah. So this has nothing to do, you know, nothing to do with, you know, the Buddhism does not hold that there's anything wrong with a body. There's nothing wrong with sex. It only when our attachment and our fixation become problematic around bodies and sex, that Buddhism would say, well, maybe you ought to begin to look at that and work with some means to help yourself, because it's become a problem for yourself. In and of itself, there's nothing. Buddhism is not. It doesn't see a problem in that. Only when it becomes a problem that it needs to be worked with. Okay, so we take a break. Have a cup of tea. So we've looked at anger, and we've glanced at attachment, and we're going to look at just briefly go through some of the remaining two negative emotions of pride and jealousy. Are there any comments or questions before we go on, or anything people like to share or bring up? Compassion and empathy. Compassion most simply is the wish that another not, that a being not suffer. So, I think empathy is one of the causes for compassion, because you have to feel that be able to share in the experience that this person is suffering and that they don't want to suffer. And therefore, you respond by wishing that they didn't suffer. As your empathy becomes stronger, I think empathy is the cause of compassion, but as your empathy becomes stronger, your compassion becomes stronger, and it's not a matter of you have to have one before the other. They play together, yeah. So empathy, we begin to, we develop the ability to feel, just very simply, what the other person might be experiencing. And we have to check up, because sometimes we can be wrong. Yeah, sometimes. So it's. But if we had, oh, I know. If that would have happened to me, that would have hurt. And then having a sense of what that person is experiencing, I wish they weren't hurting. And that's compassion. So unless we can have a sense that the other person's hurting, we can't wish them not to suffer. So we have to have somebody be able to identify. We have to be able to empathize to some degree that they are hurting. Before you can wish them not to hurt sincerely. So, okay, pride. In the Sanskrit and Pali, in these texts, pride is referred to by the word mana. And the reason I go to this, it gives us a good understanding maybe it gives us a feeling, more of a feeling than simply working with the English equivalent. And mana, at its core, means measure. You know, we have like the word pramana and so forth, which means the best measure. Mana means measure. So, in pride, the mind is holding on to an inaccurate measure of ourselves. There's an inflated measure. We're going beyond the proper measure of the qualities that we do have. We're projecting qualities upon ourselves which in fact we don't have, but we feel that we do. So the idea is we're like puffed up. We're going beyond the measure of what's actually there. And this is reflected in the Tibetan word for pride, which is nagyal. Nagyal means I king. You know, I'm the best. Something like that. So essentially pride is an attachment to an image of ourselves, or a self representation of ourselves which we attribute attributes to, which in fact we don't possess. Which in reality we don't possess. But we're holding on to that notion about ourselves very strongly. It might be in terms of our beauty and of our intelligence, of our education, of our class, of our family, you know, and so forth. Our status, our skill. We can be proud about almost anything, really. You know, I guess you could even... I'm the worst person in the world, you know. Yeah, at least I'm best at something. You know, I may not be much, but I don't. Anyway, you get the idea. So, but I think actually pride is quite, and I know it in my own experience. It can be very subtle. And I think sometimes we can. Not identify within ourselves. We think, well, you know, I'm not a very proud person, but there are certain symptoms which are indicative that maybe we're coming from a place of pride. For example, you know, when we are criticized, or we're judged by others, and how you react to that, you know, or when we feel unhappy because we're not number one. Or we feel, or we're jealous of those who do something better than ourselves. Or we feel angry when we don't receive the respect that we deserve. That's a big one for me. And I don't deserve to be treated like this. I know that's my pride showing itself. When we get angry at being criticized, what's funny about that, I think, is. You know, I can say, oh, I went to VI today and I gave a terrible talk. That's okay. But if somebody else were to say that, you know, that would be a catastrophe. Yeah. Then I'd get really angry. And that anger would be coming from a place of pride. You know, or we feel depressed. This is a big one. Many of us share it. We feel depressed about making mistakes. you know, or we feel bad about our faults. That would be symptomatic of pride. We have we're working with an inflated self-image of ourselves, and we're not living up to that image in some way. So with all of these negative emotions, with all the emotions, it's good to make some kinds of distinctions, nuances, and so forth, because we can talk about a healthy sense of pride, or what we might call, you know, use another word, just avoid confusion, a sense of self-esteem. So pride is an overinflation, feeling superior and perhaps looking down upon others, you know, about some quality about ourselves in one way or another, you know. But in with a self-esteem, or we have an accurate measure about who and what we have, our qualities about ourselves. We have a sense of our own self-worth, in other words, which is not inflated, which is an accurate measure. You know, it might be in terms of our good qualities, it might be in terms of our achievements. You know, maybe I'm a good pianist, maybe I'm a good artist, maybe I'm whatever. You know, you say, okay, according to the conventions of the world, I can do this pretty well. It doesn't mean that, you know, one can have a good, and one can take away from that a sense of self-worth, feeling good about yourself, respecting oneself in a very healthy way. This one is not comparing oneself, for example, and nor is one overinflating one's ability around these areas. So it's an accurate, we can take an accurate measure of ourselves and feel good about that. You know, it reflects an accurate measure of it. When we authentically, you know, for example, when we authentically develop our practice, and we may reduce our pride, yet we may remain distinctly orientated toward knowing and expressing our feelings, asserting ourselves, you know, asserting our individuality, our own, displaying our creativity. You know, it's like, I know how to do this, and we just get on with it. There's no sense of a feeling of superiority in doing it. Or, you know, I can paint, or I know a lot about computers. You know, let me do that. I can do that well. Or I have a talent here. It's just, you know, this is, you know, we, you know, the opposite of, I guess the opposite of pride is humility, isn't it? But what is humility? Humility doesn't mean that you're putting yourself down at all. It has nothing to do with that. It means that you are working from, you have an accurate sense of self-worth, and you are centered within that. There's a certain stability about you. You don't feel fragile. You don't have to keep propping yourself up. And you're coming from a centered place within yourself. So what are looking at some of the disadvantages of pride? And I think, you know, it's quite useful to look at these areas. Because it prevents us from, because I think for one thing it's so subtle that we're coming from a place of pride, and it interferes with, to a large extent, with our relationships with others. And you may not know what is the difficulty. Why am I not? What is the problem here? We seem to be having some, something's not going right in our relation, the way, and it may be in some subtle way, it's simply a matter of pride. So, you know, pride leads us to abuse and criticize those we feel who are lesser than ourselves in some way or another. It causes us to feel competitive toward those who we see as equal to ourselves. It causes us to have envy toward those who we see as superior to ourselves in some way. So it's also, pride is said to be one of the main obstacles to learning. You know, it's a person with pride is so filled up with themselves that there's no space for any new knowledge, for any new understanding. So it's a very closed-minded attitude. You know, one of the great lessons that I learned this was in Italy when I was teaching the master's program, is to be able to, I had to learn how to say, I don't know. That might sound rather simple-minded for many of you, but it was, I thought I had to be an encyclopedia of knowledge, and I had to be able to answer every question. And it was, I put a lot of burden on myself, a lot of pressure on myself. And it was a great relief when I finally realized, hey, I can say, I don't know. And I think it was coming from a place of pride, because I think, I should know. I should know every question, you know, every doubt, every question that they have, I should have an answer for it one way or another. So saying, I don't know, or, hey, I'm not feeling so great today. You know, I don't have to be on top of it all every day. I don't have to feel, in a, and I'm still a worthwhile person. Something like that. So being able to say things aren't going all that well. And not in a self-indulging way, but just an accurate portrayal, an expression of where you're at. And then there's some kind of communication opens up. You know, rather than coming from a place of how the appearance which you wish people to know you by, out of a matter of pride. You know, I'm okay. That kind of sense. I've got it together. In one way or another, so it in the context of mind training, it said pride is one of the main obstacles to cherishing others. In the sense that it's difficult for us to be able to identify with others when we're feeling superior to them. You know, this is quite an important element in therapy situations, in working with clients. You know, we talked about this. I think very briefly, when in talking about the equality of self and others, if you're coming from a place of pride, over and above the apparent benefit that you may be giving, you may be in fact be undermining the other person. You know, there's no one needs us to feel sorry for them, to pity them. Beneath the apparent benefit we may be giving, we may be undermining their own self-confidence. You know, you're great, and I'm this poor schmo over here. And, you know, they already feel bad about themselves. And we're aiding them into feeling, assisting them in the process of feeling even perhaps even more bad about themselves. Coming from a place of pride, look what I can do for you. I feel good about myself and what I can do for you. That kind of place. So then, and these messages are very subtle. You know, we pick up a lot more than we are aware of in our communication. And we're communicating all the time in some way or another. Just little, the words we use, the facial expressions, the tone of voice. It's all saying a lot. And we can't, in a way, the other person is aware of it. They might not be able to articulate it. So and this is a big one. I know this from my own experience, and I'm a case example for all these negative emotions, okay? That's why I find them so fascinating, because I'm working. The only reason I talk about this is because I'm working with my own mind here. We always, a person with pride has to always be on the defensive. You know, we have to be on guard against anything which would undermine the self-image which we're trying to maintain. You know, we feel this vulnerability. We feel very fragile. Just the slightest criticism, slightest remark, like an arrow shot into your heart. We're stressed out all the time, trying to keep up this image in front of others and in front of ourselves as well. You know, it becomes very difficult in that way. We become highly sensitive in this way, or overly sensitive. I guess a better way to say it. Anything that might be taken as a criticism, we become easily offended. And people start to creep around us. You know? They can't really be honest with ourselves, because you walk around so fragile, as if you're going to break if a little harsh criticism comes your way. They can't really be honest with you. That's all coming from pride. You know, we appear ridiculous to others. You know, by showing off, you know, bragging about ourselves. You know, some people, the world revolves around them. You know, and it's difficult to communicate with such people. It's difficult to, carry on, to have any intimacy with them. develop any real communication with somebody who's full of themselves, is full of their own pride. Pardon?
So many in this world today that we can deal with, we have to deal with anyway. I mean, people with pride.
Yeah. Okay, so you really can't get to know the person. Yeah, so they're just putting on this appearance. Yeah, and that's all they're willing to for you to get to know. Yeah. So one can be that's a healthy pride. Yeah, like self-esteem, self-worth. Is that what you mean? Oh, okay. Yeah, that would undermine your self-image, that if that I'm all together, I don't need your sympathy, because I'm together, I'm okay. Yeah, I think most all of us walk around like that. I think that's one of the beautiful things about Buddhism, is one of the very first teachings that the Buddha gave was the truth of suffering. And if that's kind of taken on board, we begin to have a sense that we can be suffering, but it's not personally our fault, in the sense that I'm not uniquely screwed up. You know, everybody else is, that there's something particularly wrong with me, that the truth of suffering. I'm not okay and you're not okay, but that's okay. That's the nature of our ordinary human existence. So it normalizes suffering, is what I'm saying. You know, that there's nothing, we haven't been singled out by the universe for special treatment. You know, how difficult life is for us. It's difficult for everybody. And so that automatically, you know, understanding this, we have some kind of shared foundation from which we can relate with. And it's not as if, oh, that person's together and I'm all screwed up, therefore, you know, we're unequal in some way. I think, you know, it's interesting that the fact that everybody wants to be happy, no one wants to suffer, that's like it's fundamental. But we have so many misunderstandings about each other. We know, you know, as the Dalai Lama, he has come to a group and say, oh, it's good to meet old friends again. People he's never even seen before. You know, we know something very intimate about each other. You know, everyone in this room. You know, I might not know your particular details. I don't know if I want to know your particular details. But I do know something very intimate about you, very fundamental, that you want to be happy, you don't want to suffer. And you're probably dissatisfied in many ways. You're probably suffering in many ways in your life, just like me. And that automatically, there's some acknowledging that, you know, setting aside our pride that I'm okay, you know, that opens up a level of intimacy and communication amongst ourselves, and a sharing, a sense of commonality, of camaraderie amongst ourselves. Anyway, got off. I don't know if I. We, yeah. No one's happy when they're full of pride. And then we've got to keep up this front. You know, that's a lot of work. It takes a lot of energy, a lot of our time and resources go into presenting a certain appearance, even to ourselves. So I think pride is very subtle. It can be. I mean, some people it's more obvious, I think, perhaps. But for most of us, it's not so obvious. But nonetheless, it's there, and I think it's good to recognize it. I know many of, when I have, I was challenged, some difficulties in our relation with my partner, Betsy. A lot of it simply comes from a place of pride, wanting to be right, or having to be right, and to feel okay about myself. Not willing to say, well, no, I was wrong about that, wasn't I? And that kind of willingness to admit where we're coming from. Yeah, it's not easy, is it? No. And sometimes, oh, I'm right, Well, why don't you just admit you're wrong, Come on, let's get on with it. If we didn't have so much pride, we wouldn't have all these problems. Yeah. So he's very, he models a very good example for us, yeah. And then, I'm going to try to finish here. So excuse me while I just race on here. Some antidotes or ways to work with pride that you might consider. Thinking, if I were really so great and as wonderful as I sometimes think, imagine that I am, I wouldn't be having these problems that I really do have. I wouldn't still be suffering the way I am. In spite of all the blood, sweat, and tears that I've expended over the course of my life, trying to figure out how to lead a good life and how to be happy and everything, if I were all that I sometimes imagine myself to be, I would have by now I should have solved all my problems, but I haven't. We begin to own our own shortcomings, our own wounds. That's why one of the traditional antidotes, for example, Shanti Deva mentions in the engaging the Bodhisattva's way of life is to meditate on suffering. It's very humbling to realize how much, in fact, we do suffer. And if I was as great as I sometimes imagine myself to be, I shouldn't be suffering now any longer. So, the sense of humility is a direct antidote to pride. What's there to be so proud of, in fact? So then you can also meditate on impermanence. We can take pride in our, which many people do, in their bodies, their beautiful body. Well, not mine, perhaps, but but that body is impermanent. You're not always going to have it, or your wealth, or your status, look at what goes up will come down eventually. So, or your strength, or your talents, the things deteriorate. So this can overcome our sense of impermanency around these areas, can overcome our sense of pride that we take into it, because, again, it's coming from a sense that this is going to last forever, this beauty of mind, or whatever it might be. You can reflect upon, the kindness of others, and this requires some reflection. I remember, once the Dalai Lama said, speaking of the Dalai Lama, he said, "Even my fame depends upon others. Nothing is coming from my side. People are making me famous. There's nothing famous about me by way of my nature." So, all of what we have is, in some way, dependent upon others. It's not somehow our own, as if we, it originated within ourselves. It's all dependent in that way. And this is a good one, I think. Consider And when I see these 7-year-olds playing with these computers, and it just blows my mind. You know, there's so much more. You know, all this science and philosophy. You know, you begin to look into it, and all this information that keeps coming out. You know, I know almost nothing. You know, when you think of it in that way, and in this context, it's useful. I would say, in general, it's not so useful. But in this context, bringing to mind some fault, maybe some past negative action. You know, it's like we're puffed up. If you bring to mind some past negative action or some fault, it's like sticking a little pin in it. You deflate a little bit. That kind of, in general, it's not so good to be mindful of your faults, but this has a particular application where it's useful in this context, only in this context, I'd say. Recognizing that pride is, or we could say arrogance, is a defense mechanism. It's not a very effective. You know, probably we don't feel so good about ourselves, but we put on this arrogant front. It's like a defense to make us feel good about ourselves. In that way, we can bring to mind the good qualities of others. You know, for example, the Dalai Lama. You know, our teachers. You know, but Martin Luther King, Nelson Mandela, Mother Teresa. You know, these wonderful people who have dedicated so much of their lives and had these wonderful qualities, and it kind of puts ourselves in a bit of a proper perspective. You know. I'm not saying I don't have good qualities, but we get a more accurate measure when we begin to consider the qualities of others in this way, which is I think is good. So in this particular context, I think it's useful. We can begin as we did with anger and so forth. Who is it that's so full of pride? I'm the best thing that ever came to Sydney. And that kind of, who is it that, you know, who is underneath that, who's building this big story about being so wonderful and how great we are and so forth. There's a useful saying that I come up, I think, quite a lot. It's kind of a double edge. It's quite useful. If I can remember it right, I'm not as wonderful as I sometimes imagine, nor as bad as I sometimes think. You know, it would be an interesting area to investigate. Sometimes we can, at the same time, sometimes, not at the same time, but alternatively, we can sometimes feel puffed up about ourselves. Other times we feel that we're the lowest thing, you know, we're lower than the mud puddles on the road. We can feel terrible about ourselves, very insufficient, inadequate. So our minds can go both ways, it would seem. So I'm not as wonderful as I sometimes imagine, nor as bad as I think. You know, we can find some kind of more accurate measure about ourselves. And then finally, I want to talk about jealousy. In the Abhidharma, so the Abhidharma is that area of, you know, there are three categories of the teachings of Buddhism, you know, usually classified into three categories, what are called the sutras or discourses of the Buddha, the Vinaya or the areas of, which set out the rules of discipline, especially for monks and nuns and so forth. And then Abhidharma, which it deals with the area of psychology and cosmology and the nature of the universe, the nature of the mind, and has all these various categorizations and lists. If you like lists, Abhidharma is great. Lots and lots of lists. So, you know, if you're into contract law, it has all these very detailed descriptions of the nature of the universe and all the way down to an atom, and various mind states and so forth. So in Abhidharma, or this what is sometimes called, referred to as higher knowledge or area around psychology and so forth, classifies jealousy as an area of within, as a part of hostility. So it's defined as a disturbing emotion that focus upon other people's accomplishments. Other people's accomplishments could be a variety of possibilities. It could be their good qualities. It could be their possessions or some success that they enjoy. And has an inability to bear their accomplishments due to an excessive attachment to our own need for respect that we wish to receive. So it is a disturbing emotion or an afflictive emotion or a negative emotion that is viewing other people's accomplishment. Maybe they're rich, maybe they're famous, maybe they're beautiful, whatever it might be. And it finds, I just can't stand that they're so beautiful, that they're so rich, you know, that they're so highly looked at in the world, their accomplishments in some way, because of one's own attachment to getting these things for oneself, to being respected for oneself, or gained for oneself. So there's a certain element of resentment. That's why it's reclassified as an area of hostility. So we're focused upon some area of the life of another person, and whether it's accomplishments and so forth, and we exaggerate the attraction. You know, it must be wonderful to be a movie star. Oh, they must be fantastically happy and having all that adoration, and you know, to be a rock star. Wow, that would be the, you know. So I don't know how wonderful it is to be a rock star. It could be, I don't know. But anyway, in our eyes, it's just the most wonderful possible thing you could be. So there's a certain, again, there's an exaggeration. All of the afflictive emotions have this. One of the qualities is an exaggerated superimposition of some sort of the qualities, of the attractive qualities, of the negative qualities in some way. We make this the central, at that moment that we're being jealous, this becomes a central focus of our concern. It's like your whole life centers around this quality, and we base our sense of self-worth around this. That, you know, we our well-being is dependent upon, you know, being a rock star. Oh, I wish I was a rock star. I wish I was like, give me a rock star. Who? No. Jimmy Barnes. Oh, if only I could be Jimmy Barnes. God, wouldn't that be great? Something like that. I don't know. So, who? Paris Hilton. Paris, I don't know. If only I could be Paris Hilton. Okay. And so we become totally preoccupied. There's a preoccupation with an attachment to that me. So there's a central me in this, with all of this. A central. If only I could be like Paris Hilton. Then my life would be bliss. I don't know. Anyway. And we fixate on that. That's right. That's the envy part. We call envy. We're going to make a distinction between there's jealousy, which resents that person for being where they are, and oh no, you're right. That sounds good. There's three qualities or emotions that we can talk about here. I don't know, we can make a distinction. Jealousy, envy, and one of the 10 unskillful actions, which is called covetousness. Yeah, there's three unskillful actions of mind, or three negative actions of mind. Covetousness, ill will, and wrong view. And so we can make a distinction. Like, for example, come to that, okay? There's an inability to rejoice. The opposite state of jealousy is rejoicing, being glad that this person has whatever it is, delighting that this person has found that fame or that has a wonderful, beautiful body. Or, yeah, so one is unable to rejoice. One doesn't feel jealous of suffering. And I'm jealous that this person is really has cancer. And we don't, generally we don't do that. It's something that's very attractive to us, that we find, and that they have it, and we find it unable to bear that they have that. They're still looking. Yeah. Yeah. Fickle, yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. So that shouldn't, if you become a rock star, don't get attached to it.
No.
Okay. If you become Paris Hilton. Oh, I see.
It's something that they're supposed to get so much money. And on the other end of the world, people have no bread, no water, no
money.
It's very unfair.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't know if it
doesn't seem.
That's jealousy or envy or whatever, I don't know, but that's how I see it.
Yeah. No, I can appreciate what you're saying. It doesn't seem just, does it? Yeah. No. Yeah, I can appreciate that. Yeah. So you might become from a place of compassion. Yeah. Compassionate attitude. Wanting to right it, what you see as injustice. Yeah. I'm just going to. So, So jealousy is preoccupation with ourselves, okay? Whereas, for example, covetousness, one of the three unskillful actions of mind, it is an inordinate desire for something possessed by others. You know, if you have beauty, or you have material objects, you have a nice car, status, power, money, whatever it might be, wanting that for myself. So it's wanting something that somebody else has. That's what we mean by covetousness. Now, so I wanted to make that distinction, because if we add jealousy and envy together, we come up with what's called envy. And envy is resentment. When we become of the advantages that are enjoyed by others in some way, we desire what they have. We think we should have it, and we resent them for having it. You know, it's envy is a combination of jealousy and covetousness, and it eventually this leads to a sense of competitiveness. You know, we are driven to outdo other people in some way or another, because we're jealous or of what others have or envious of their accomplishments and so forth. So we push ourselves, or we push those around us. You know, if we're an employer, we push our employees out of jealousy and so forth. It can't, you know, it's like the image which is made of use in the iconography of Buddhism is a horse racing. A horse can't stand that the other horse wins. So that kind of jealousy. And then we could go through all the various disadvantages of jealousy. I mean, I think jealousy is pretty heavy duty emotion. I think most of us can be aware of it. Our minds are unhappy when we're jealous, or we are fearful that others may have something that we don't have. We're on guard in that way. We, out of jealousy, you can destroy friendships. You know, jealousy can make us look foolish in front of others and so forth. You may plot to how you can destroy others' happiness, or, you know, cutting down other people's, like tall poppies, what we were just talking about. You know, out of jealousy, we might, a lot of gossip is, as its motivating force is jealousy. You know, talking badly about others, putting people, others down and so forth. Out of jealousy, we hurt other people's feelings and so forth. Just talking very quickly about some of the antidotes around jealousy. And we said that the opposite state is rejoicing. You know, being able to taking delight or being glad. You know, isn't it wonderful that Paris Hilton has all that she has? Or Jimmy Barnes, remember? Whatever talents or material wealth, possessions and so forth, rejoicing what others have. You know, it's said to be, I remember when I was very clever, I thought I was very clever when I came in contact with Buddhism. And I went to, this was when I was living in Dharamsala in India, and I went to see Trichan Rinpoche, who was a teacher of Lama Zopa and Lama Yeshe and so forth. He was very highly regarded. He was the junior tutor to His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And I thought, I wanted to be very clever, so I thought I'd come up with a very clever question. and I said, what's the easiest way to practice Dharma? And as it turned out, it wasn't such a... it wasn't so stupid after all. And he said, rejoice. So if you're able to... And it's very profound. We've got 3 minutes to go into profundity here, but just being able to delight in the good fortunes of others, it creates a tremendous amount of if we use a traditional terminology, of good karma, you know, positive potential. But there's other profound nature of that ability to delight in what others have, how it begins to work against your own self-centeredness and your own attachments and your inability to rejoice in others and so forth. Again, the notion of impermanence, that whatever they have, it's impermanent. Even if you were to have it, you know, even if you were to get all that money, that talent and so forth, it's not going to last. It's impermanent. And, you know, we're always talking about, and we're going to be talking about, sneaking a commercial here, about the four immeasurables beginning next month. We'll begin with the first of which is immeasurable love, which is simply most the wish that others be happy. And here it is, somebody's happy. And why should you resent them being happy when, you know, when you're trying to develop the immeasurable love? You should be glad. Wow, my job is that much easier now. And somebody's happy. And why begrudge them the happiness? And then I think this is a good one. I think, imagine if we were the best. If we were the best. You know, if I was the best Buddhist teacher in the world, what a terrible place the world would be. And we'd be in terrible shape, wouldn't we? If I were the best. You know what I mean? if I was the best carpenter or I was the best plumber, well, things would be a disaster. You know, so it's the world would be in a sad shape if I were the best or the most talented in any particular area. Something like that, and there's somebody else. I'm really happy that there are better teachers than myself. I'm really happy there are better plumbers than myself. I'm really happy better electricians. If I was the best electrician in the world right now, we wouldn't have electricity, right? You know, the lights would be out for weeks at a time, or that we wouldn't have light at all. So, just by way of conclusion, then we're going to stop. In working with one of the underlying notions I'm trying to get across is that emotional change doesn't come about from simply an intellectual decision. You know, for example, saying, from today onward, I'm not going to get angry. I'm going to be a compassionate person. From today onward, I'm going to be a generous person. I'm not going to be attached. From today onward, I'm going to be humble. It'd be nice if we could do that. If we try that, and I think many of us try that in some way or another, we are going to have to suppress those emotions which we no longer wish to identify with in ourselves. We're going to suppress it by way of meditative training, or we're going to through excessive intellectualization, or by rational thought. In some way, our practice will be simply orientated toward avoiding failure, not toward developing beneficial qualities. We're always going to have to suppress and be on the lookout for any indication that, oh, my practice isn't going right. I had a moment of anger. I had a moment of attachment, and so forth. We're going to cultivate an unawareness to those very qualities which we're seeking to suppress, which we're seeking to avoid in some way. I don't think that works very well. So we have to learn to, what we're trying to do is learning about these states, and we have to be willing to become familiar with them, to see how they're actually operating, to see, you know, beginning to see what is true and beneficial and what is deceptive and harmful. So we're beginning to apply this discriminative awareness, this intelligence. We have a better idea and experience of what does and does not work, and what is and is not appropriate. So I think in this way, change will occur. Change occurs as a matter of like a gradual unfoldment of insight, and not what I'm trying to address here is simply not a matter of willpower. Trying to force ourselves into some preconceived mold of how I should be. Even if we're trying to, I respect people who are trying to practice sincerely, but we have to bring a certain intelligence to that. And I think we can do that. Okay, thank you. So we'll go, next month we'll start the four immeasurables. It's all his fault. It's all his fault. Don't blame me.
Have a bit more meditative experience on some of the topics of the lamb room.